Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The True Love by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull. This book is copyrighted 1992 by Patrick O'Brien. This recording is copyrighted 1995 by Recorded Books.
Chapter 1. Standing at the frigate's taffrail, and indeed leaning upon it, Jack Aubrey considered her wake, stretching away neither very far nor emphatically over the smooth, pure, green-blue sea. A creditable furrow, however, in these light airs. She'd just come about with her larboard tacks aboard, and as he expected, her wake showed that curious nick where, when the sheets were hauled aft, tallied and belayed, she made a little wanton gripe, whatever the helmsman might do. He knew the surprise better than any other ship he'd served in. He'd been laid across a gun in a cabin just below him and beaten for misconduct when he was a midshipman. And as her captain, he too had used brute force to teach reefers the difference between naval right and naval wrong. He'd served in her for many years, and he loved her even more than his first command. It was not so much as a man of war, a fighting machine, that he loved her. For even when he first set foot aboard so long ago, neither her size nor her force had been in any way remarkable. And now that the war had been going on for 20 years and more, now that the usual frigate carried 38 or 36 18-pounders and gauged 1,000 tons, the surprise, with her 28 9-pounders and her less than 600 tons, had been left far behind. In fact, she and the rest of her class had been sold out of the service or broken up, and not one remained in commission, although both French and American yards were building fast, shockingly fast. No, it was primarily as a ship that he loved her, a fast, eminently responsive ship that, well handled, could outsail any square-rigged vessel he'd ever seen, above all on a bowline. She'd also repaired his shattered fortunes when they were both out of the Navy. Himself struck off the list and she sold at the block. Then he sailed her as a letter of marque. But although that may have added a certain immediate fervour to his love, its true basis was a disinterested delight in her sailing and all those innumerable traits that make up the character of a ship. Furthermore, he was now her owner, as well as her captain. For Stephen Maturin, the frigate surgeon who bought her when she was put up for sale, had recently agreed to let him have her. And what was of even greater importance, both man and ship were back in the Navy. Jack Aubrey reinstated after an exceptionally brilliant cutting-out expedition, and after his election to Parliament, and the frigate, as His Majesty's hired vessel surprise. Not quite a full reinstatement for her, but near enough for present happiness. Her first task in this particular voyage had been to carry Aubrey and Maturin, who was an intelligence agent as well as a medical man, to the west coast of South America. There to frustrate French attempts at forming an alliance with the Peruvians and Chileans, who led the movement for independence from Spain, and to transfer their affections to England. Yet, since Spain was then at least nominally allied to Great Britain, the enterprise had to be carried out under the cover of privateering, of attacking United States South Sea whalers and merchantmen, and any French vessels she might chance to meet in the East Pacific. This plan had been betrayed by a very highly placed, but as yet unidentified traitor in Whitehall, and it had had to be postponed. Aubrey and Maturin, going off on quite a different mission in the South China Sea, eventually keeping a discreet rendezvous with the surprise on the other side of the world, in about 4 degrees north and 127 degrees east at the mouth of the Salababu Passage, the frigate, in the meantime having been commanded by Tom Pullings, Jack's first lieutenant, and manned, of course, by her old privateering crew. Here they sent her more recent prizes away for Canton, under the escort of the Nutmeg of Consolation, the charming little postship lent to Captain Aubrey by the Lieutenant Governor of Java, and so proceeded to New South Wales, to Sydney Cove itself, where Jack hoped to have his stores renewed and several important repairs carried out against their eastward voyage to South America and beyond, and where Stephen Maturin hoped to see the natural wonders of the Antipodes, particularly Ornithorhynchus paradoxus, the duck-billed platypus. Unfortunately, the governor was away, and Jack's hopes were disappointed because of the ill will of the colonial officials. And the fulfilment of Stephen's very nearly killed him, for the outraged platypus, seized in the midst of his courting display, plunged both poison spurs deep into the incautious arm. It was an unhappy visit to an unhappy, desolate land. But now the odious penal shores had sunk in the west. Now the horizon ran clean round the sky, and Jack was in his old world again, aboard his own beloved ship. Stephen had recovered from his distressing state, immensely swollen, dumb, blind and rigid, with extraordinary speed. The bluish, leaden colour of his face had returned to its usual pale yellow, and he could now be heard playing his cello in the cabin, a remarkably happy piece he had composed for the birth of his daughter. Jack smiled. He was very deeply attached to his friend. But after a couple of bars he said, "Why Stephen should be so pleased with a baby, I cannot tell. He was born to be a bachelor. No notion of domestic comforts, family life. Quite unsuited for marriage, above all for marriage with Diana. A dashing, brilliant creature, to be sure. A fine horsewoman and a capital hand at billiards and whist, but given to high play and something of a rake. Quite often shows her wine. In any case, quite improper for Stephen. Has nothing to say to books. Much more concerned with breeding horses. Yet, between them, they've produced this baby. And a girl at that." The wake stretched away, as true as a taut line now. And after a while he said, "He longed for a daughter, I know, and it's very well that he should have one. But I wish she may not prove a platypus to him." And he might have added some considerations on marriage and the relations so often unsatisfactory between men and women, parents and children, had not Davidge's voice called out, "Every rope and end," cutting the thread of his thought. "Every rope and end." The cry was automatic, perfunctory and superfluous. For having put the ship about, with rather more conversation than was usual in a regular man-of-war, but even more neatly than in most, the surprises, in the nature of things, were rapidly coiling down the running rigging, braces and bowlines, just as they'd done thousands of times before. Yet without the cry, something would have been missing, some minute part of that naval ritual which did so uphold sea-going life. Sea-going life? None better, reflected Jack. And certainly at this point in time he had something like the cream of it, with a good, tolerably well-found ship, for the returning governor had done all he could in the few days left, an excellent crew of former Royal Navy hands, privateersmen and smugglers, professional from clue to earring, with his course set for Easter Island, and many thousand miles of blue water sailing before him. Above all, there was his restoration to the list. And though the surprise was no longer in the full sense a king's ship, both her future as a yacht and his as a sea officer were as nearly assured as anything could be on such a fickle element. In all likelihood he would be offered a command as soon as he came home. Not a frigate, alas, since he was now so senior, but probably a ship of the line, possibly a small detached squadron as commodore. In any event, a flag, being a matter of seniority and survival rather than merit, was not so very far distant. and the fact that he was Member of Parliament for Millport, a rotten borough in the gift of his cousin Edward, meant that, independently of his deserts, this flag would almost certainly be hoisted at sea. For, rotten borough or not, a vote was a vote. This certain knowledge had been with him ever since the Gazette printed the words, "Captain John Aubrey, Royal Navy, is restored to the list with his former rank and seniority, and is appointed to the Diane of 32 guns, filling his massive frame with a deep, abiding happiness. And now he had another, more immediate reason for joy, his friend having made this astonishing recovery. "Then why am I so cursed snappish?" he asked. Five bells. Little Reed, the midshipman of the watch, skipped aft to the rail, followed by the quartermaster with the logship and reel. The log splashed down, the stray line ran gently astern. "Turn," said the quartermaster in a hoarse, tobacco-chewing whisper, and Reed held the 28-second glass to his eye. "Stop!" he cried at last, clear and shrill, and the quartermaster wheezed, "Three, 1.5, mate." Reed gave his captain an arch look, but seeing his grim, closed expression, he walked forward and said to Davidge, "Three knots, 1.5 fathoms, sir, if you please," directing his voice aft and speaking rather loud. The wake span out, rather faster now than Jack had foretold, hence the arch look. "Crossing the mooring and bloody-minded with it like an old and ill-conditioned man. It's discreditable in the last degree," he said. And his thoughts ran on. Profound attachment to Stephen Maturin didn't preclude profound dissatisfaction at times, even lasting dissatisfaction. For a quick and efficient refitting of the ship, good relations with the colonial administration had been of the first importance. But in that very strongly anti-Irish and anti-Catholic atmosphere, Botany Bay had been filled with United Irishmen after the 97 Rising, the presence of Stephen, irascible, more or less Irish and entirely Catholic, rendered them impossible. Or, to put it more fairly, not just his presence, but the fact that he had resented an insult after a Government House dinner on his very first day in the penal colony, blood all over the Bath stone steps. Jack had had to endure weeks of official obstruction and harassment, the vexatious searching the ship for convicts trying to escape, the stopping of her boats, the arrest of mildly drunken liberty men ashore. And it was only when the Governor returned that Jack had been able to put a stop to all this by promising him that the Surprise should carry no absconder from Port Jackson. Stephen, poor fellow, couldn't really be blamed for the misfortunes of his birth, nor for having resented so very gross an insult, but he could be blamed, and Jack did blame him, for having, without the least consultation, planned the escape of his former servant Padeen Coleman, equally Popish and even more Irish, virtually monoglot, whose sentence of death for robbing an apothecary of the laudanum to which, as Stephen's loblolly boy, he had become addicted, had been commuted to transportation to New South Wales. The matter had been presented to Jack when he was exhausted with work and last-minute preparations, frustrated beyond description by a light, froward, conscienceless woman, liverish from official dinners in the extreme heat, and their difference of opinion was so strong that it endangered their friendship. The escape did, in fact, take place in the confusion that followed Maturin's encounter with the platypus, and Padeen was now on board. It took place with the consent of Padeen's master and of the entire crew, and it could be said that Captain Aubrey's word was unbroken, since the absconder came not from Port Jackson, but from Woolloo Woolloo, a day's journey to the north. Yet, for his own part, Jack dismissed this as a mere quibble. And in any event, he felt that he had been manipulated, which he disliked extremely. That was not the only time he'd been manipulated, either. Throughout the voyage from Batavia to Sydney, Jack Aubrey had been chased. Necessarily so, given the absence of anyone to be unchaste with. And throughout his anxious, frustrating negotiations in Sydney, he'd been chaste, because of total exhaustion by the end of the day. But after Governor Macquarie's return, all this changed. At several official and unofficial gatherings, he met Selina Wesley, a fine, plump young woman with a prominent bosom, an indifferent reputation and a roving eye. Twice they were neighbours at dinner, twice at supper parties. She had naval connections, an extensive knowledge of the world, and a very free way of speaking. They got along famously. She had no patience with Romish monks or nuns. She said celibacy was great nonsense, quite unnatural. And when, during the interval in an evening concert given in some gardens outside Sydney, she asked him to walk with her down to the tree fern dell, he found himself in such a boyish state of desire that his voice was scarcely at his command. She took his arm, and they moved discreetly out of the lantern light, walked behind the summer house and down the path. "We have escaped Mrs. MacArthur's eye," she said, with a gurgle of laughter, and her grasp tightened for a moment. Down through the tree ferns, down, and at the bottom, a man stepped out of the shadows. "There you are, Kendrick," cried Mrs. Wesley. "I wasn't sure I should find you. Thank you so much, Captain Aubrey. You'll find your way back easily enough, I'm sure, steering by the stars. Kendrick, Captain Aubrey was so kind as to give me his arm down the path in the dark." He had other causes for discontent, such as the faint and even dead contrary airs that had kept Bird Island in sight for so long, and then the curious falsity of the trade wind that obliged the ship to beat up close-hauled day after day, wearing every 4 hours. Other causes, some of them trivial. He had taken only 2 midshipmen from the Nutmeg into the Surprise, 2 for whom he felt a particular responsibility, and both of them were extremely irritating. Reed, a pretty boy who had lost an arm in their battle against sea dyaks, was overindulged by the Surprises and was now much above himself, while Oakes, his companion, a hairy youth of 17 or 18, went about singing in a most unofficer-like manner, a kind of bull-calf joy. Jack skipped over the matter of Nathaniel Martin, the Reverend Nathaniel Martin, an unbeneficed clergyman, a well-read man and an eager natural philosopher who had joined the Surprise as assistant surgeon to see the world in Maturin's company. It was impossible to dislike Martin, a deeply respectable man, though his playing of the viola would never have recommended him anywhere. Yet Jack couldn't love him either. Martin was, of course, a more suitable companion for Stephen in certain respects, but it seemed to Jack that he took up altogether too much of his time, prating away about primates in the mizzen top, or endlessly turning over his collection of beetles and mummified toads in the gunroom. Jack passed quickly on, he didn't choose to dwell on the subject, and came to the strange, unaccountable behaviour of the frigate's people. Obviously they were not like a Royal Navy crew, being much more talkative, independent, undeferential, partners rather than subordinates. But Jack didn't dislike that at all. He was used to it, and he thought he knew them intimately well from his cruises with them as a privateer and from this long run from Salababu to New South Wales. Yet something seemed to have happened to them in Sydney. Now they were fuller of mirth than before. Now they had private expressions that caused gales of laughter in the forecastle. And now he often saw them look at him with a knowing smile. In any other ship this might have meant mischief, but here the officers had something of the same oddness. At times even Tom Pullings, whom he'd known since his first command, seemed to be watching him with a considering eye, hesitant,
quizzical.
Causes for discontent, vexations. Of course he had them, and none rankled like that caper in the tree ferns, nor came more insistently into his humiliated mind so full of unsatisfied desire. Yet all these put together, he thought, couldn't account for this growing crossness, this waking up, ready to be displeased, this incipient ill-humour, anything likely to set it off. He'd never felt like this when he was young, had never been made game of by a young woman either. "Perhaps I shall ask Stephen for a blue pill," he said. "For a couple of blue pills. Haven't been to the head this age." He walked forward, the windward side of the quarter-deck emptying at his approach. And as he passed the wheel, both the quartermaster at the con and the helmsman turned their heads to look at him. The surprise instantly came up, half a point. The windward leeches of the topsails gave a warning flutter, and Jack roared, "Mind you, helm, you infernal lubbers! What in hell's name do you mean by leering at me like a couple of moonsick cowherds? Mind you, helm, do you hear me there? Mr. Davidge, no grog for Krantz or Webber today." The quarterdeck looked suitably shocked and grave. But as Jack went down the companion ladder towards the cabin, he heard a gale of laughter from the forecastle. Stephen was still playing, and Jack walked in on tiptoe with a finger to his lips, making those gestures that people use to show that they are immaterial beings, silent, invisible. Stephen nodded to him in an absent way, brought his phrase to a full close, and said, "You've come below, I find." "Yes," said Jack, "not to put too fine a point on it, I have. I know this isn't your time for such things, but I should like to consult you, if I may." "By all means. I was only working out a few foolish variations on a worthless theme. If what you have to say is of an intimate nature at all, let's close the skylight and sit upon the locker at the back." Most consultations shortly after a ship had left port were for venereal diseases. Some seamen were ashamed of their malady, some were not. In general, the officers preferred their state not to be known. "It's not really of an intimate nature," said Jack, closing the companion nevertheless and sitting on the stern window locker. "But I'm most damnably hipped. Cross even in the morning and much ill-used. Is there a medicine for good temper and general benevolence, a delight in one's blessings? I'd thought of a blue pill with perhaps a touch of rhubarb." "Show me your tongue," said Stephen. And then, shaking his head, "Lie flat on your back." After a while, he said, "As I thought, it is your liver that is the peccant part, or at least the most peccant of your parts. It is turgid, readily palpable. I have disliked your liver for some time now. Dr. Redford disliked your liver. You have the bilious facies to a marked degree. The whites of the eyes are dirty yellow, greyish-purple half-moons below them, a look of settled discontent. Of course, as I've told you these many years, you eat too much, you drink too much, and you do not take enough exercise. And this bout, I have noticed that although the water has been charmingly smooth ever since we left New South Wales, although the boat has rarely exceeded a walking pace, and although we have been attended by no sharks at all, in spite of Martin's sedulous watch and mine, you have abandoned your sea-bathing. Mr. Harris said it was bad in my particular case. He said it closed the pores and would throw the yellow bile upon the black. Who is Mr. Harris? He's a man with singular powers. Recommended to me by Colonel Graham when you were away on your tour of the bush. He gives you nothing but what grows in his own garden or in the countryside, and he rubs your spine with a certain oil. He's performed some wonderful cures, and he's very much cried up in Sydney. Stephen made no comment. He had seen too many quite well-educated people run after men with singular powers to cry out, to argue, or even to feel anything but a faint despair. "I shall bleed you," he said.
and mix us gentle, Chulagog.
And since we are now quite clear of New South Wales and of your thaumaturge's territory, I advise you to resume both your sea bathing and your practice of climbing briskly to the topmost pinnacle. Very well. But you don't mean me to take medicine today, Stephen. Tomorrow's divisions, you remember? Stephen knew that for Jack Aubrey, as for so many other captains and admirals of his acquaintance, taking medicine meant swallowing improbable quantities of calomel, sulphur, turkey rhubarb, often added to their own surgeon's prescription, and spending the whole of the next day on the seat of ease, gasping, straining, sweating, ruining their lower alimentary tract. "I do not," he said. "It's only a mixture to be followed by a series of comfortable enemata." Jack watched the steady flow of his blood into the bowl. He cleared his throat and said, "I suppose you have patience with, desires. It would be strange if I had not. I mean, if you'll forgive a gross expression, with importunate pricks. Sure, I understand you. There is little in the pharmacopoeia to help them. Sometimes, waving his lancet, I propose a simple little operation. A moment's pang, perhaps a sigh, then freedom for life. A mild sailing on an even keel tossed by no storms of passion. Untempted, untroubled, sinless. But when they decline, which they invariably do, though they may have protested that they would give anything to be free of their torments, why then, unless there is some evident physical anomaly, all I can suggest is that they should learn to control their emotions. Few succeed, and some, I'm afraid, are driven to strange, wild extremes. But were the case to apply to you, brother, where there is a distinct physical anomaly, I should point out that Plato and the ancients in general made the liver the seat of love. Cogit amare jacor, said the Romans. And so I should reiterate my plea for more sea bathing, more going aloft, more pumping of an early morning, to say nothing of a fitting sobriety at table, to preserve the organ from ill-considered freaks. He closed the vein, and having washed his bowl in the quarter gallery, he went on, "As for the blue devils, of which you complain, my dear, do not expect too much from my remedies. Youth and unthinking happiness are not to be had in a bottle, alas. You are to consider that a certain melancholy and often a certain irascibility accompany advancing age. Indeed, it might be said that advancing age equals ill temper. On reaching the middle years, a man perceives that he is no longer able to do certain things, that what looks he may have had are deserting him, that he has a ponderous great belly, and that however he may yet burn, he is no longer attractive to women. And he rebels. Fortitude, resignation, and philosophy are of more value than any pills, red, white, or blue." "Stephen, surely you'd never consider me middle-aged, would you?" "Navigators are notoriously short-lived, and for them middle-age comes sooner than for quiet, abstemious country gentlemen. Jack, you have led as unhealthy a life as can well be imagined. Perpetually exposed to the falling damps, often wet to the skin, called up at all hours of the night by that infernal bell. You have been wounded the dear knows how many times, and you have been cruelly overworked. No wonder your hair is grey." "My hair is not grey. It's a very becoming buttercup yellow." Jack wore his hair long, clubbed and tied with a broad black bow. Stephen plucked the bow loose and brought the far end of plait round before his eyes. "Well, I'm damned," said Jack, looking at it in the sunlight. "Well, I'm damned, you're quite right. There are several grey hairs. Scores of grey hairs. It's positively grizzled like a badger pie. I'd never noticed.
Six bells.
Will I tell you something more cheerful?
Asked Stephen.
Please do, said Jack, looking up from his cue with that singularly sweet smile Stephen had known from their earliest acquaintance. Two of our patients have been to the two islands you mean to pass. That is to say, Phillips has been to Norfolk Island and Owen has been to Easter Island. Phillips knew the place before it was abandoned as a penal station, and he knew it extremely well, having spent, I believe Martin said, a year, for it was to him that Phillips spoke about the place. In any event, a great while after the ship to which he belonged was wrecked, I forget her name, a frigate. That must have been the Sirius, Captain Hunt. Heaved onto a coral reef by the swell in the year 90, much as we were so very nearly heaved onto the rocks of Inaccessible on the way out. Lord, I've never been so terrified in my life. Was you not terrified, Stephen? I was not. I don't suppose there is my equal for courage in the service. But then you recall I was downstairs, playing chess with poor Fox, and knew nothing of it until we were delivered. But, as I was saying, Martin was delighted to hear that the mutton birds would be there by now. He loves a petrel even more than I do, and the mutton bird, my dear, belongs to that interesting group. He very much hopes that we may go ashore. Certainly, I should be happy to oblige him if landing is possible. Sometimes the surf runs very high, by all accounts. I shall have a word with Phillips, and I shall ask Owen to tell me all he knows about Easter Island. If this breeze holds, we should raise Mount Pitt on Norfolk tomorrow morning. I hope we shall be able to go ashore. Apart from anything else, there's the famous Norfolk Island pine. Alas, I'm afraid it was exploded years ago. The enormous great spars wouldn't stand even a moderate strain. To be sure. I remember Mr. Seppings reading us an excellent paper at Somerset House, but what I really meant was that so prodigious and curious a vegetable as the Norfolk pine may well harbour equally prodigious and curious beetles, as little known to the world in general as their host. Speaking of Martin, said Jack, who didn't give a pinch of snuff for beetles, however singular, I thought of him twice yesterday. Once because while I was going through the mass of estate papers with Adams, trying to get them in some kind of order, they came from seven different lawyers after I had paid off my father's mortgages and the children had tumbled them about to get at the stamps, he pointed out that I had three advowsons and part of a fourth, with the right of presenting every third turn. I wondered whether they would interest Martin. Aren't they of any value? I've no idea. When I was a boy, Parson Russell of Woolcombe kept his carriage, but then he had private means, and he'd married a wife with a handsome dowry. I've no notion of the others, except that the vicarage at Compton was a sad, shabby little place. I went to sea when I was no bigger than Reed, you know, and hardly ever went back. I had hoped that Withers' general statement of the position would reach me in Sydney. That would give all the details, I'm sure. What was the second circumstance that brought Martin to your mind? I was restringing my fiddle when it occurred to me that love of music and the ability to play well had nothing to do with character. Neither here nor there, if you follow me. Martin's two Oxford friends, Standish and Poulton, were perfect examples. Standish played better than any amateur I had ever heard. But he wasn't really quite the thing, you know. I don't say that because he was perpetually seasick, or because he ratted on us, nor do I mean he was wicked. But he wasn't quite the thing. Whereas John Poulton, who played even better, was the kind of man you could sail round the world with and never a harsh word or a wry look all the way. What astonished me is that Martin should have played with two such very capital hands and that neither should ever have persuaded him to tune somewhere near true pitch. Jack regretted this fling against Stephen's friend as soon as it was out. It sounded malignant. And he quickly went on, and it is odd that they should both have become papists. You find it odd that they should revert to the religion of their ancestors?
Not at all, cried Jack, feeling low. I only meant it as though there were an affinity between music and Rome.
So we are to have divisions tomorrow, said Stephen.
Yes. I was sorry to miss them last week.
They have a good effect in pulling the crew together after a long run ashore, and they allow one to take the ship's pulse, as it were. The people have surely been behaving rather strangely, simpering, making antique gestures.
Jack's tone was that of inquiry, but Stephen, who knew perfectly well why the people were simpering and making antique gestures, only said, I must remember to shave.
The surprise, in her present state, carried no marines and a much smaller crew than a regular man-of-war of her rate. No landsmen, no boys, and very little in the way of gold, lace and glory. But she did possess a drum. And at 5 bells in the forenoon watch, the ship being under a great spread of sail, with the gentle, steady breeze 1 point free, the sky perfectly clear, and Mount Pitt in Norfolk Island sharp on the horizon at 12 or 13 leagues west, the officer of the watch said to Oakes, the mate of the watch, beat to divisions. Oakes turned to Pratt, the musically gifted seaman, and said, beat to divisions. Whereupon Pratt brought his poised drumsticks down with a fine determination, and the generale boomed and roared throughout the ship. This surprised no one. Shirts and duck trousers had been washed on Friday, dried and prettied on Saturday. During the long breakfast of Sunday morning, the word clean to muster had been passed, and in case anyone had not seized the message, Mr. Bulkley, the boatswain, had bawled down the hatches, do you hear there, fore and aft? Clean the muster at 5 bells. While his mates, even louder, called, you hear there? Clean shirt and shave for muster at 5 bells. Long before this, the forenoon watch had brought up their clothes bags and had stowed them in a hollow square on the quarter-deck abaft the wheel, leaving a space over the companion to let daylight into the cabin. And at 4 bells, the watch nominally below brought up theirs and made a pyramid of them on the booms before the boats. Not without a good deal of jocular shoving and calling out, laughter and jokes about Mr. O in the middle watch. It would never have done for the Royal Navy. And some of the old man-of-war's men tried to quieten their privateer shipmates. But by the time their officers had lined them up, and by the time each had reported his division present, properly dressed and clean, sir, to Pullings, they really looked quite presentable. And Pullings was able, with a clear conscience, to turn to Captain Aubrey, take off his hat and say, all the officers have reported, sir. Then we'll go round the ship, if you please, replied Jack, and all fell mute. The first division was the afterguard under Davidge, who saluted and fell in behind his captain. All hats flew off. The seamen stood as straight and as motionless as could be in the heavy swell, and Jack walked slowly along the line, looking attentively into the familiar faces. Most retained their ceremonial expression. Killick, standing there with his mouth set in disapproval, might never have seen him before. But in a few he thought he detected a look of something he could hardly name. Amusement? Knowingness? Cynicism? In any case, a lack of the usual frank, amiable vacuity. On to West. Poor, noseless West. A victim of the biting frost far south of the Horn. And his division, the Wasters. And as Jack inspected them, so down in the sick berth, one of their number, an elderly seaman named Owen, absent from divisions because of illness, said, and there I was on Easter Island, gentlemen, with a proby clawing off the lee shore and me roaring and bawling to my shipmates not to desert me, that they were a hard-hearted set of buggers, and once they'd scraped past the headland, they put before the wind. Never started a sheet until they crossed the line, I swear. And did it profit them at all, gentlemen? No, sirs, it did not.
they was all murdered and scalped by Pechoki's people north of Nootka Sound, and their ship was burnt for the iron. How did the Easter Islanders use you?
Asked Stephen.
Oh, pretty well, sir, on the whole. They're not an ill-natured crew, though much given to thieving. And I must admit they ate one another more than was quite right. I'm not over-particular, but it makes you uneasy to be passed a man's hand. A slice of what might be anything, I don't say no when sharp set, but a hand fair turns your stomach. Howsomever, we got along well enough. I spoke their language after a fashion. How did that come about? Asked Martin. Why, sir, it's like the language they speak in Otaheite and other islands, only not so genteel like the Scotch. You're familiar with the Polynesian, I collect, asked Stephen. An answer? The South Sea language. Bless you, sir. I've been in the Society Islands this many a time, and sailing on the fur trade run so long to Northwest America when we used to stretch across to the Sandwiches in the winter when trading was over, I grew quite used to their way of it too, much the same in New Zealand. Anyone can speak South Seas, said Phillips, the next patient on the starboard side. I can speak South Seas. So can Brenton and Scroby and old Chucks. Anyone that's been in a South Sea whaler. And then I had a girl, and she helped me to a lot of their words. We lived in a house built by the old uns a great while ago and ruined, though our end was sound enough. It was a stone house shaped like a canoe, about 100 foot long and 20 wide, with walls 5 foot thick. On Norfolk Island, me and my mates cut down a pine 210 foot high and 30 round, said Phillips. Captain Aubrey, accompanied by Mr. Smith the gunner and Mr. Reed, reached the end of the next division, made up of the captains of gun crews, quarter gunners, and the armourer. And as he looked attentively at the bearded Nehemiah Slade, the captain of the gun called Sudden Death, the ship, impelled by a freakish double crest, gave a great lee lurch. Although Jack had been at sea from his boyhood, even his childhood, he could still be caught off balance. And now, while the gunners were all heaved back to leeward against the hammock netting, he plunged into Slade's bosom. The general roar of honest mirth that followed this might account for the amusement in the next division, the foretopmen, the youngest, brightest, most highly decorated members of the ship's company, who were led by Mr. Oakes. Although he was a plain, thick-faced youth, he was unusually popular. He was often drunk, always jolly, with a great flow of animal spirits. He never tyrannised, nor did he report any sinner. And although he was no great seaman in the navigational or scientific way, he would run up to the iron cross trees with the best of them and there hang upside down. And then another wonderful thing about Easter Island, said Owen, is what they call moles. There's nothing wonderful about moles, said Phillips. Pipe off, Phillips, said Stephen. Go on, Owen. It's what they call moles, said Owen rather more distinctly than before. And these here moles is platforms built on the slopes of hills with the walls on the seaward side maybe 300 foot long and 30 foot high, all made of squared stone, sometimes 6 foot long. And on the platforms, there are huge great images carved out of grey rock and brought there to be set up. Images of coves as much as 27 foot high and 8 across the shoulders. Most of them were thrown down, but some of them were still standing, with great red round stone hats on the tops of their heads. And these here hats, because I sat on one with my girl, one that had been thrown down, is 4 foot six across and 4 foot four high, measured with my thumb. With a certain sense of relief, Jack came to the forecastle, where he was received by Mr. Bulkley the boatswain and Mr. Bentley the carpenter, in their good West of England broadcloth coats, grave men, but scarcely graver than the forecastle hands, prime middle-aged seamen who, having taken off their hats to the captain, smoothed their hair over pates that were sometimes bald on top, and whose waist-length pigtails were often eked out with tow. Behind these, in the days when the Surprise was in regular commission, there would have stood the ship's boys under government of the master-at-arms. But a privateer had no room for boys, and their place, ludicrously enough, was now taken by two little girls of even less value in fighting the ship, Sarah and Emily Sweeting, Melanesians from the remote Sweetings Island, the only survivors of a community wiped out by the smallpox brought by a South Sea whaler. They'd been carried aboard by Dr. Maturin, and the task of looking after them naturally fell to Jemmy Ducks, the ship's poulterer, who now whispered to them, "Toe the line and make your bob." The little girls fixed their bare black toes exactly on a seam in the deck, plucked the sides of their white duck frocks, and curtsied. "Sarah and Emily," said the captain, "I hope I see you well." "Very well, sir, we thank you," they replied, gazing anxiously into his face. On to the galley, with its coppers shining like the sun, the cheerful cook and his sullen assistant, Jack Nastyface, whose name, like Chips for the Carpenter or Jemmy Ducks, went with the office. On to the lower deck, where the hammocks swung by night but empty now, with a candle in each berth and a variety of ornaments and pictures laid out pretty on the seamen's chests. Not a hint of dust, not even a gritting of fine sand underfoot. And the light sloping down through the grating, such elegant shafts of parallel rays. Jack's heart lifted somewhat, and they came to the midshipman's berth, cabins built up on either side and reaching as far aft as the gunroom. Too small in the days when the frigate carried so many masters, mates, midshipmen and youngsters, too big now that she had only Oakes and Reed. Particularly as Martin, the surgeon's mate, and Adams, the captain's clerk, lived and messed in the gun room, where the purser, masters, and marine officers' cabins all stood vacant. They didn't look into the gun room, though it would have borne the severest, most hostile inspection, even the stretchers of the officers' table having been polished above and below, but went down towards the sick berth, which Stephen preferred to the traditional bay, area but far more noisy, a place where affectionate messmates found it easier to make his patients drunk. "And another thing that would please you, gentlemen," said Owen, "is the noddies, or turns, as some say. They arrive when the stars and the moon are just so, and the people know it to a day. They arrive in thousands and thousands, all screaming, and make their nests on an island just offshore, rising like the Bass Rock, only much more so. On Norfolk Island are millions and millions of mutton birds," cried Phillips. "They come in at dusk, dropping out of the sky and going to their burrows, for they live in burrows. And if you go to the mouth of the burrow and call keek, 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 he answers keek, 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 and he pokes his head out. We used to kill 1,200 or 1,400 a night." "You and your mutton birds," began Owen. Then he stopped, his ear cocked. Jack opened the door. Stephen, Martin and Padine stood up. The invalids assumed a rigid posture. "Well, Doctor," said the captain, "I hope you find our pumping is answered." Ever since Stephen had spoken of the Surprise's stench below as compared with the Nutmeg's purity, sea water had been let into her hold every night and pumped out in the morning to purify her bilges. "Tolerably sweet, sir," said Dr. Maturin, "but it must be confessed that this is not the Nutmeg. And sometimes, when I recall that the ship was originally French and that the French bury their dead in the ballast, I wonder whether there may not still be something of a charnel house down there." "Quite impossible. The ballast has been changed again and again, scores of times." "So much the better. Yet even so, I should be grateful for another ventilating pump. In this heavy, breathless air, the patients have a tendency to grow fractious, even to quarrel. Make it so, Captain Puddings, said Jack, and if any hand should presume to quarrel, let his name be entered in the defaulters list. Here, sir, said Stephen, are the men I was speaking about. Phillips, who knows Norfolk Island well, and Owen, who spent several months among the Easter Islanders. Ah, yes. Well, Phillips, how are you coming along?
Very indifferent, sir, I'm sorry to say,
said Phillips in a weak, gasping voice. And Owen, how are you?
I don't complain, sir, but the burning pain is something cruel.
Then why the devil don't you keep out of brothels, you damn fool, a man of your age? Low knocking shops in Sydney Cove, of all places, where the pox is the worst in the world. Of course you burn. Then you're always at it, every goddamn port. If your pay were docked for venereals as it is in the regular service, you wouldn't have a penny coming to you when we pay off, not a brass farthing.
Captain Aubrey, still breathing hard, asked the other patients how they did. They were all much better, thank you, sir. And returning, he said to Phillips, so you were in Sirius when she was heaved ashore. Was there no good holding ground near the island?
No, sir, said Phillips, speaking like a Christian now. It was terrible, coral rock everywhere inshore.
Was far worse off of Easter Island, sir. Coral rock far offshore too, then no bottom with the deep sea line and an almighty surf, said Owen, but in an undertone.
We couldn't land on the south side of the island, sir, so we went round to the northeast.
And there we were, lying to, with a light breeze off the shore and all hands fishing for gropers, when the supply brig, who was laying outside of us, hailed Captain Hunt that we was being heaved inshore, which was true. It was all hands make sail, and make sail we did. But then the flood set in. It sets for the north on that side of the island, sir. And what with that and the swell, we couldn't make head against it, not even with the breeze on our quarter. We let go both bows, but the coral cut their cables directly. We let go the sheet anchor and the spare, and they parted too. And at one bell in the afternoon watch, we struck, drove farther over the reef, and cut away our masts. Our captain gave orders to open the after hatchway and stave all the liquor. All this Phillips had delivered with barely a pause. Now he drew breath, and in the interval Owen said, on Easter Island, sir.
Doctor, said Jack, I shall ask Mr. Adams to see these men separately and take notes of what they have to say. Now I'm going forward to see what your pumping has done about our rats as well as our smell. Coleman, the lantern there.
In his hurry, Padine dropped the lantern, lit it again, dropped it once more, and was cursed for an unhandy grass-combing lubbub in a tone of much greater severity and exasperation than was usual in Captain Aubrey, who left a disapproving silence behind him and a certain consternation. Stephen didn't discuss the ship's captain with anyone, nor, obviously, did he discuss his friend Jack in the gunroom. But he could perfectly well speak of the patient Aubrey with Martin, a man of strong good sense and exceptionally wide reading. Reverting to Latin, he said, I have rarely, perhaps never, seen such a high degree of irascibility, so continuous and, as it were, cumulative irritation in this particular subject. It is clear that there has been no good effect from either my animator or my chorogog. And this steady and increasing exacerbation makes me fear that this is not an ordinary congestion of the hepatic ducts, but some disease acquired in New South Wales. In his medical capacity, Martin had nothing to do with moral values, and he replied, When you say disease, do you refer to that which is so usual among seafaring men, high or low?
Not in this case. I put the question directly, had there been any commerce with Venus?
No, said he with surprising vehemence. There had most certainly not. Adding a remark that I didn't catch, there is something strange here.
And it's with real concern that I recall dear Dr. Redfern's account of the various forms of hepatitis he has seen in the colony, sometimes associated with hydatic cysts. He showed me one from a person who had lived entirely on kangaroo and rum, and there was an unparalleled degree of cirrhosis. But worse than that for our purposes was his casebook, showing long drawn-out histories of general bilious indisposition, melancholy, tedium vitae, sometimes reaching mere despair, extreme irascibility. All this with no known agent. Though autopsy showed an enlarged quadrate lobe studded with yellow nodules the size of a pea. He calls it Botany Bay liver. And it is this, or some one of the other New Holland diseases, that I fear our patient may have caught. The vexation, and more than vexation of spirit, is certainly present. It's deeply saddening to see what disease can do to a whole cast of mind, to a settled character, said Martin. And sometimes our remedies are just as bad. How it appears to draw in the boundaries of free will. The doctor may say what he likes, Tom, said Captain Aubrey, but I think the surprise smells as sweet as the nutmeg, or sweeter. They were approaching the cable tier now, for the surprise had a catwalk that allowed uninterrupted progress from the after platform right forward. The cable tier, where the great ropes lay coiled, together with the hawsers and cablets. These always came aboard sodden, often stinking and covered with slime, there to lie dripping through spaces between the planks down into the hold. But now, since the surprise had lain at moorings in Sydney Cove or had tied up to bollards, they were warm and dry. Jack remembered luxuriating in their folds when he was young, sleepy from the morning watch, and willing to escape from the din of the reefer's berth. Sweet, to be sure, sir, said Pullings, but there are still vermin about for all our pumping. I've seen a score since the sick berth. He made a nimble kick at one far-travelled and particularly audacious Norway rat that had come aboard at Sydney and sent it flying over the nearest coil to the lattice bulwark behind. With a shrill screech, a figure darted from behind the cables, brushing the rat away. What the devil are you doing here, boy? Cried Jack. Didn't you hear the drum beat for divisions? Who the devil are you? Then, relaxing his iron grip and standing back a little, what is this, Mr. Pullings? Pullings held up the lantern and said in a neutral voice, it's a young woman, I believe, sir. She's wearing a reefer's uniform. Jack took the lantern, and looking even bigger than usual in its light, he studied her for a moment. Pullings was obviously right. Who brought you here? He asked, with cold displeasure.
I came of myself, sir,
said the girl in a trembling voice. This was utter nonsense. It could be demolished in a minute. But he didn't wish to make her lie and lie until she was driven into a corner and forced to bring out the name. Obvious enough, in all conscience. Let us carry on, Mr. Pullings, he said. What on earth are here? You heard me, sir. Take the lantern. They silently inspected the sail rooms, the bosun's, gunner's, carpenter's storerooms, the pitch room, and so returned to the open air, where all hats came off once more and where all faces changed at the sight of Captain Aubrey's pale severity. We shall not rig church, Captain Pullings, he said. The articles will do very well for this occasion. The parade, such as it was, dissolved, and the hands moved aft, lining the quarter-deck as far as the companion hatchway, and sitting on benches or stools or capstan bits poised between two match-tubs, or on the belaying bits round the mainmast. Chairs were placed for the captain and the officers on the windward side, for the midshipmen and the warrant officers to the lee. A sword rack covered with an ensign and holding the articles of war stood in front of Captain Aubrey. And all this time the sun shone from a clear sky. The warm air breathed across the deck, slanting from forward with just enough strength to fill her great array of canvas. There was very little sound from the breeze, the rigging or the blocks, and the water only whispered down the side. Norfolk Island, rising and falling on the long, even swell beyond the larboard bow, was perceptibly nearer. Nobody spoke.
"Silence fore and aft,"
called Pullings. And after a moment, Jack stood up, opened the thin boards that held the articles, and began. There were 36 of them, and 19 of the offences named carried the death sentence, sometimes qualified by the words, "or such other punishment as the nature and degree of the offence shall deserve and the court-martial shall impose." He read them deliberately, with a powerful voice. And the articles, already inimical, took on a darker, more threatening tone. When he'd finished, the silence was still quite as profound. And now there was a greater uneasiness in it. He closed the boards, looked coldly fore and aft, and said, "Captain Pullings, we will take in the royals and haul down the flying jib. When they're stowed, hands may be piped to dinner." It was a quiet meal, with little or none of the shouting and banging of mess kids that usually greeted the Sunday plum duff and the grog. And while it was being eaten, Jack walked his quarterdeck, as he had so very often walked it before. 17 paces forward, 17 paces aft, turning on a ring bolt, long since polished silver by his shoe. Now, of course, the half-heard jokes, the covert allusions to Mr. Oakes's weariness, his need for a sustaining diet and so on, were perfectly clear. He turned the situation over and over in his mind. Flashes of pure exasperation interrupted his judgment from time to time, but he felt in perfect command of his temper when he went below and sent for the midshipman. "Well, Mr. Oakes," he said, "what have you to say?"
"I've nothing to say, sir,"
replied Oakes, turning his oddly mottled face aside. "Nothing at all, and I throw myself on your mercy. Only we hoped, I hoped, you would carry us away from that horrible place. She was so very unhappy."
"I'm to take it she was a convict?"
"Yes, sir, but unjustly condemned, I'm sure." "You know perfectly well that I've turned away dozens, scores of others." "Yet you let Padeen come aboard, sir," said Oakes, and then clasped his hands in a hopeless, stupid attempt at unsaying the words, doing utterly away with them.
"Get away, forward," said Jack. "I shall take no action, make no decision today, this being Sunday, but you'd better pack your chest."
When he'd gone, Jack rang for a steward and asked whether the gunroom had finished their dinner.
"No, sir," said Killick. "I doubt they're even at their pudding yet."
"Then when they have finished,
when they've quite finished, mind,
I should like to see Captain Pullings.
My compliments,
and I should like to see Captain Pullings." He looked doggedly through the sheets of physical observations he'd made for Humboldt. Temperature and salinity of the sea at various depths, barometric pressure, temperature of the air by wet and dry bulb thermometer, a chain of observations more than halfway round the world, and he derived a certain satisfaction from them. Eventually he heard Pullings' steps.
"Sit down, Tom,"
he said, waving to a chair.
"I've seen Oakes, and the only explanation he could bring out was that she was very unhappy. And the damn fool threw Padeen in my teeth."
"You didn't know, sir?"
"Of course I didn't, did you? I believe it was common knowledge in the ship, but I had no certainty. Nor did I inquire. My impression was that the situation being so delicate, you didn't choose to have it brought to your attention or for there to be any question of returning to Botany Bay. Was it not your duty as First Lieutenant to let me know?"
"Perhaps it was, sir. And if I've done wrong, I'm very sorry for it." In a regular king's ship with a pennant, a party of marines, a master-at-arms and ship's corporals, I couldn't have avoided knowing it officially. And then, in duty bound, I should have been obliged to inform you. But here, with no marines, no master-at-arms and no ship's corporals, I should have had to listen at doors to be certain. No, sir. Nobody wanted to tell either me or you, so that you, officially in the dark until it was too late, couldn't be blamed, could sail on for Easter Island with an easy conscience. You think it's too late now, do you? Whittles is up, sir, if you please, said Killick at the door of the dining cabin. Tom, said Jack, we left that odious wench at the starboard cable tier. I dare say Oakes has fed her, but she can't stay there watch after watch. She'd better be stowed forward with the little girls until I've made up my mind what to do with her. This was one of the few Sundays when no guests had been invited to the cabin, the captain feeling so out of sorts. One of the few Sundays when Dr. Maturin dined in the gunroom. And Aubrey sat in the solitary splendour usual in some captains, but rare in him. He liked seeing his officers and midshipmen at his table, and particularly his surgeon. Not that Stephen could in any way be called a guest, since they'd shared the cabin these many years, and until recently he'd actually owned the ship. He might have been expected for coffee, but in fact Jack saw nothing of him until the evening, when he walked in with a dose of Eclista. He and Martin had spent the intervening hours describing the more perishable specimens from their tour in the bush and writing to their wives. "Here's a pretty kettle of fish," cried Jack. "An elegant goddamn kettle, upon my word." Solitude and a heavy afternoon sleep had increased his ill humour, and Stephen didn't at all like the colour of his face. "What's afoot?" he asked. "What's afoot?" "Why, the ship's turned into a bawdy house. Oakes has had a girl in the cable tier ever since we left Sydney Cove. Everybody knew, and I've been made a fool of in my own command." "Oh, that, it's of no great consequence, brother. But as for being made a fool of, it's no such matter, but rather a mark of the people's affection, since they wish to avoid your being placed in a disagreeable posture." "You knew, and you didn't tell me?" "Of course I didn't. I couldn't tell my friend Jack without at the same time telling Captain Aubrey. Authority incarnate. And you're to observe that I am not and never have been an informer. Everyone knows how I hate a woman aboard. They're worse than cats or parsons for bad luck. But quite apart from that, quite rationally, no good ever came of women aboard. Perpetual trouble, as you saw yourself at Juan Fernandez. She's an odious wench, and he's an ungrateful scrub. Have you seen her at all?" "I caught a glimpse of her in the cable tier just after leaving you this morning. Have you?" "I have, too. I went along to ask the little girls how they did, and to hear them their piece of catechism, and there I found a midshipman with them, a young midshipman I didn't know, a handsome youth. Then I perceived that he was a young woman, and I begged her to sit down. We exchanged a few words. Her name is Clarissa Harville, and she spoke with a becoming modesty. She is clearly a woman of some family and education, what is ordinarily called a gentlewoman. Gentlewomen do not get sent to Botany Bay." "Nonsense. Think of Louisa Wogan." Jack gave the unanswerable Louisa a passing glance and returned to his fury. "Bawdy house," he cried. "It'll be the lower deck full of Portsmouth brutes next and a miss in every other cabin. Discipline all to pieces. Sodom and Gomorrah." "Dear Jack," said Stephen, "if I didn't know that your liver was speaking rather than your head, or, God preserve us, your heart, this righteous indignation and solemnity would grieve me, to say nothing of your broadside of first stones, for shame. As you told me yourself long ago, the service is a sounding-box in which tales echo for ever. And it is perfectly well known throughout the ship that when you were about Oak's age, you were disrated and turned before the mast for hiding a girl in that very part of the ship. Surely you must see that this Pope Holy Sanctimonious attitude has a ludicrous as well as a most unamiable side. You may say what you please. but I shall turn them both ashore on Norfolk Island. Pray take off your breeches and bend over that locker," said Stephen, sending a jet from his enema through the open stern window. A little later, and from this position of great moral advantage, he went on, "What surprises me extremely in this whole matter is that you should so mistake the people's frame of mind. But then, in many ways, as their surgeon, I am closer to them than you are. It appears to me that you do not sufficiently distinguish between the ethos of the man of war and that of the privateer. The prevalent feeling or tone of this community is far, far more democratic. Consensus is required, and whatever the law may say, you command the surprise. The surprise as a privateer, only because of the respect that people have for you. Your commission is neither here nor there. Your authority depends wholly upon their respect and esteem. If you were to order them to put a callow youth and a slip of a girl down on a virtually abandoned island and sail on with me and Padeen, you would lose both. You have many old followers on board who might say, 'My captain right or wrong,' but you have no marines, and I do not think the followers would prevail with the community as it now stands, and with its overriding sense of what is fair and right. You may put your breeches on again. Damn you, Stephen Maturin, and damn you, Jack Aubrey. Swallow this draught half an hour before retiring. The pills you may take if you do not sleep, which I doubt."